Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.
Entree Architect membership has monthly training, unlimited access to business resources, a video library, and a private member forum with hundreds of entrepreneur architects just like you. Everything you need to build a better business is available now at Entree Architect. Subscribe today at entrearchitect.com/join. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 278. And recently, I moderated a live webinar session for a couple of friends of mine as they revealed their findings and answered questions about their in-depth study on public interest design firms. They answered dozens of questions about the model, including how the model works and why sometimes it doesn't. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, how to start a public interest design firm with Maya Sharfi and Gilad Maron of Proactive Practices. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, Gusto, easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for the modern small business. RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM, specifications, and so much more. And FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love.
All right. Hi, folks. Thank you for being here. We're excited that you're here. We're excited to have this last of our three-part webinar series, where it is not just us sharing our perspective, but us getting to be in dialogue with you. And I want to hand things over to actually somewhat of a longtime friend of ours, Mark LePage, who runs Entree Architect, also runs a podcast. It was one of the first podcasts we were on. Mark really knows what it is to be an architect. His whole business is designed around helping small firm architects move forward and really hit success and align their businesses with the lives and impact that they want to make. And so we are really excited that he agreed to come on and to be our moderator for our session today. So I'll hand it over to you, Mark.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you both for inviting me on, because I love doing this. I love what you're both doing. I love Proactive Practices and what the entire platform stands for. And so when you invited me on to do this, I was really excited. So thank you for inviting me on here. The idea of this session, Maya, you did the first session. Gilad, you did the second session. I encourage anyone who's on the call who has not watched those sessions to go back and watch them, because they're very, very interesting. And if you're interested in public interest design, It gives you a very good overview of the entire concept and what they've learned and how it works and why it doesn't work when it doesn't work. So it's very, very interesting to go back there. This call is intended to sort of be a call where it's going to be focused on you. And so we're hoping that you have a lot of questions, that maybe you watch those webinars and you're like, well, I want to do that. I want to be part of that, but I don't know how. So I'd love for you to start posting questions in the chat box. We're welcoming you and encouraging you to come online and speak. You know, you can turn on your cameras, you can turn on your audio. If you can't do that for any reason, just post in the chat box and we'll open up the audio and the video for you. But definitely post some questions. I have a bunch of questions too, because I'm interested too, and I have a bunch of questions that I want to ask. But we'll kick things off with sort of a general question to both of you, Maya and Gilad. If I'm somebody who watched those videos and I'm inspired and this is something that's in me and I found those videos and I found you because I'm interested in it and I want to do this, I want to build a public interest design firm, how do I get started? And I want you to sort of look at this from three different perspectives, because there could be three different ways that we're pursuing this. Maybe one is a business owner that I've already started a firm and it's not a public interest design firm, but I want it to be. So that's sort of one question. Then maybe I'm a freelancer or an independent contractor or a student coming out of architecture school. How do I start it from scratch? And then maybe the third piece is I'm in a firm, I'm working for somebody else. I don't really want to get out of that firm. I like being an employee. I don't want to start my own firm, but how do I influence that firm to do more of this work? So how do I get started?
Yeah, I love the way you frame that, because it's these different starting points and it is different based on where you're getting started. So I have a specific take on business owner and firm. And then maybe Gilad, if you're excited to talk about freelancer and anything else, then weigh in. So I think if you're a business owner, it's an incredible opportunity to be able to align your practice with your values. And I think a lot of people, especially if you left someone else's firm, you may end up replicating the dynamics of the firm that you left, because you're not thinking about, well, who do I want to serve and how do I want to serve them and what are the ways in which I do want to serve them? So what I would suggest is that you find one either initiative or project to test out doing public interest work. It might be finding an issue in your community that you care about and trying to understand what opportunities are there in order for design to have an impact. And then I would start connecting with potential end users, potential funders, and I would try to scope out of it a small test project to get started on, or a small initiative to get started on. So an initiative can, you know, maybe it's not a traditional project, but it might be a way that you go about your work, or, you know, a certain commitment that your firm is making. So it's not quite public interest, but there's a firm that I just found out about that just made a commitment to going carbon neutral. And so you can make an impact, not just by the projects that you do, but how you do the work. So, you know, at the end of the day, you are your portfolio, you are what you achieve. And so get that first kind of point of public interest work done, and then you can start to build a body of work around it and formalize more policies around it. If you are in a practice, what I have seen be successful is there are oftentimes, again, it's getting started with one initiative, one project, it's a lot easier to test something as a pilot or a test project and then to build policy or structure around it. What we've seen be one of the most common pathways to achieving public interest design as a commitment in a firm is to have support from different levels of the organization. So years ago, when Canon Design was getting involved in public interest design, it was a group of emerging architects and then a couple key people in leadership who joined together and became each other's allies to push this forward. And I think that there's something about having alliances, you know, people at the bottom saying, we want to do this, we want to do the work, we are in the middle, you know, showing interest and proof that this is something that's worth investing in. And then people who are in other key areas of the organization who can kind of pull other influence levers. And so that alliance building skill, I think, is particularly important if you're trying to do this as an employee in a much larger firm.
Very good. Gilad, how about if I'm a a freelancer or a student or maybe even somebody who is more seasoned, has gone through the whole, you know, own my own firm, work for other people, but now I'm at a point where I want to do what I want to do. But I'm by myself solo, and I want to start doing this. How do you get started if you're sort of solo?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that is not like level of experience, you know, specific. I think people, you know, at all levels of experience grapple with these same questions. So that's just to say, if you're early on in your career and you're struggling to figure out the answers to these, know that you're not alone. I think that some of the advice I would give to students or folks just trying to find their path in this space is ironically actually the same advice I might give to someone that you just described, Mark, someone much more advanced in their career, which is to think about kind of what is the thing that is most pressing to you? What are you most passionate about? And there's kind of four areas or four types that I've seen come up fairly frequently. So I think they can be useful. This idea of like an impact type, you know, something you specifically want to create impact on, whether that's environmental impact, whether that's economic impact, whether that's political impact. There's a range of different types of impact that you might be interested in pursuing, but knowing what it is specifically that you're ultimately trying to work towards could be really helpful for kind of reverse engineering how you get there. Another that's very common is location or geography. People who are really passionate about helping their community, whether that's a small neighborhood or a city or an entire region or even a whole country, whatever it is, really honing in on what the specific location and geography of your work will be could also help you kind of create some constructive or creative constraints that lead you to finding your path. Another one is a population or a group of people, knowing that there's a certain type of community or a certain group of people you really want to work with. You know, for example, I have a friend who is Syrian and really cares about working with Syrian refugees. And she really doesn't care in what context or what work she's doing. It's about the population that she wants to be working with. So that's another one that can be helpful. And then finally, an issue area, a specific type of work. Or type of kind of issue in the world that you want to be addressing. So, for example, I feel pretty passionate about addressing the issue of homelessness and helping those who are experiencing homelessness. And that sort of focus on an issue can be really helpful. So I think whether you're a student just starting out or whether you're someone very advanced in your career, I think trying to hone in on something, whether it's a type of impact, a location, a group of people, or an issue, or something else. Those are just four examples. I think those can be really helpful in orienting you and trying to figure out what you're doing. And I realize that's not really an answer. That's just saying pick something and then figure it out from there. But I think that can actually be a really important first step so you're grounded in something, so you have a sort of base to work off of.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you both had a very similar response to that, is to start small, pick something that you can make an impact on, because maybe something that you really want to ultimately make a big, big impact on, maybe too big to start. And if you don't start small, you'll never get to the big thing that you want to get to. And so by picking something that you know that you can make an impact on and go do that, that will allow you to sort of be the stepping stone to get to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing, and then grow into the thing that you wanted it to be.
Definitely. Yeah. And I would just add one more thing to that, especially to your question of freelancers. That's kind of how I would describe myself. Something that I've found that's really helped for kind of getting your foot in the door is not doing the work, actually. It's going out and volunteering with an organization you care about, or just going to local community meetings, or doing something that's going to get you engaged in actual real communities and groups of people who are already organizing and doing work that is in the public interest or is serving a community or is advancing an issue, and just being a part of that and trying to become more familiar with it, understand the issues, understand the dynamics and the nuances, over time, start to find ways where your technical skills could be of use, could be serving that group or that organization or that group of people.
Yeah.
Mark, I just want to weigh in, though, that I think both of us are the way we would get started is we would start with something small, get proof of concept, move on to the next level. But there are some people who are go big or go home folks, right? So, you know, whether or not the plus pool, which we talked about in one of our webinars, is your example of public interest design, right? You know, whether that's your impact example, there are some people who just put out a big idea, build an alliance around it. And, you know, Daniel Burnham, who was a planner in Chicago, I grew up in Chicago, always said, make no small plans because they don't have the power to stir man's heart. Or, you know, I think I'm misquoting him somewhat, but I think that there is a pathway for some people, which is like put out a big idea and then figure out how to make it happen, build the alliance around it, see who wants to get inside that tent.
Yeah, I love that example of the plus pool and how to put that big, big idea out there and then it was out there and then people can come and say, hey, we can help you make that happen because you put that big idea out there.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. Tina has a question about how do you make this all work financially? You know, that's the, Tina, you are right there with me. Every year I'm on the jury of the Architecture Business Plan Competition with Charette Venture Group. And every year we get multiple submissions from public interest design firms or firms that sort of want to have that social side of it. And very often they sort of push that profit part to the side, you know, that they promote the triple bottom line of profit, people, and planet. But then they start talking about the people and the planet, and they sort of push the money to the side and that becomes this necessary evil. But in reality, in order for it to really work, and you've even shown this in many of your case studies, that you need to have some sort of strategy, some sort of business plan for this to actually work. So Tina's question is how do you translate that into money-making business? That's the crux of the challenge. Small test projects that are pro bono are pretty accessible. It's the business side of it that's the stumbling block for all of us. So do you have a question on, or an answer to that question on, you know, how do you keep that balance? And are there specific business models that work work better than others?
Yeah, I think I've got a few quick things, and I think Maya will have even more insight to share since this is a lot of what she focuses on now. I think one thing on the outset to keep in mind is that public interest design is not the same business model as traditional for-profit architecture or, you know, big D design firms. You're doing different types of work. It's going to require different types of funding. It's going to oftentimes require different internal organizational structures to enable that work to move forward in the right way. So the entire model is somewhat, it's very similar and can be kind of changed and translated. But I think it's important to remember that we can't simply think that a traditional for-profit architecture design firm that's been set up to do for-profit client-driven work is going to immediately just be able to take on public interest projects and not change anything about how they operate. So I think some of those things that you could change to make this more of a sort of viable business model, three quick things that come to mind. One is bidding on public sector contracts. We know that by nature, working for the public sector is working in the public interest because you're using tax dollars. Now, there's a lot of conversation and debate there about how that happens and what it actually means. But if you're working for the public sector, addressing the public's interest should be one of the top priorities of the work that you're doing. And so, therefore, the client being a department or an agency within city government, that project's inherently going to be oriented differently than a for-profit client. Another one that I think is important is going after supplemental funding. You might not be able to get all the money you need to do this type of project, but you can be applying for grants or building relationships with philanthropers or other means of getting donations, crowdsourcing. I mean, there's a host of ways to fundraise and build financial backing for a project, but thinking about the fact that you might need to do stuff outside of the design project in order to fund it. And then the third one that comes to mind is really convincing your clients, being a sort of evangelical, so to speak, for the value of investing in this type of work that can be better PR for that client, making them look good, that could enable them to have a better community, that could provide new insights about how they might be doing work in the future. There's a number of other ways to think about that, but really selling your clients on increasing the budget for the project because this is important and it's going to be valuable for you for X, Y, and Z reason.
Maya,
yeah,
you?
Yeah. So I think about it as a design problem, right? I think about it as, like I was trained as a landscape architect, very much that kind of site analysis mentality is how I approach everything. Probably, you know, even like a fight with my partner, I'm like, let's diagram it out, right? But, but you know, I think when you start to think about it as a system, you start to think, okay, what is the social issue, problem, need? And are there funding streams that are already going to solve this? Who is paying for this to be solved? What kind of player are they? How do they pay for it, right? How do we understand it structurally? So one of the practices that I have seen in we didn't know about them when we were doing our work, but I really admire them. They were written up in Curbed a couple years ago. Is this group, this planning and design group called LAMAS, that is doing facade renovation, but it's facade renovation that also has a kind of business coaching component for small and I think usually immigrant run businesses on some key throughways and some key districts in Los Angeles. And so their partners is the economic development department. And so they've got budgets, they have things that they're investing in, and it, you know, whether or not they have these facade renovation, you know, line items, not sure if they had that before LAMAS got involved, but really trying to understand who's paying for what, line item is it coming out of, and how can we position what we're going to do as an alternative, as a smarter, not harder alternative, a better use of resources. And that might mean you're not just the designer working on this, you're actually building a coalition or a collaborative where your skill set is a component of it, right? It might be about a partnership approach. So, I think that's the way that I try to think about it. And what's great about that is if you start to zero in on it, it means that you don't have to be everything to everyone, right? You don't have to make the economic development department love you and know, like, and trust you, right? We know that in order to get hired, whether you're public interest or for profit, at the end of the day, one of my business coaches says, people hire people, right? At the end of the day, it's about that know, like, and trust between key decision makers at each entity that decide to engage in this, you know, venture together, right? Even if you're getting paid to do your work, it's a shared enterprise. If anyone has ever hired another vendor or subcontractor, you know that there's an element of trust involved. So you don't have to make everyone know, like, and trust you. You can figure out who are the almost typological partners that hire, that spend money on the things that the things that go to fund the problems that you're trying to solve, and how do you position your work as an alternative, and then understand how to speak to them and how to speak to the key influencers that are around them. It really is, I think it's almost kind of like a sales training question, right? You know, people in for-profit world who are building businesses do this all the time, and it's applying this to the frame of the social problem that you're trying to address. I'll also say that there's an alternative business model which says we don't tap into the existing funding streams. We do higher profit work and we use that to subsidize the other work that we want to do. I think I mentioned this in an earlier webinar, but I am a huge fan of not doing pro bono, but doing low bono. I think that you get better outcomes when there's at least some financial stake in the game on the beneficiary's part, or at least funders who are involved with them, and on your part, right? It becomes more of that shared enterprise. I one of the things I'm thinking through in my coaching work is sometimes companies will pay to have women coached. And I've been thinking about, do I actually need to make sure that each woman has financial stake also in the coaching engagement to make sure that, you know, she's really owning the value of that work. So I think that's kind of a basic principle that I've seen be true over and over and over again. And then the last piece, which is, it's hard. It's really hard. And different firms address it in different ways, but your short term and your long term of your business are not always the same thing, right? Before you get that credibility, that proof of concept, you may need to put more sweat equity into it, right? That's what we saw with Mass Design Group. With some of the women who I coach, they might have a long game of how they're trying to position themselves. And I think the same thing is true for a business. You might have a long game of how you're trying to position yourself, and you may need a short-term either income strategy or a short-term. Growing a business is not the same as maintaining a business. And I think sometimes we try to go from here, 0 to 60 immediately. And, you know, we actually need different strategies to move through the different phases that we're in.
Vanessa has a question about funding. So let's keep that conversation going. She asks, as a firm or an individual not set up as a 501c3, are there recommendations for funding the work if the group does not have funds for quote unquote design services, or philanthropic state agencies, grants, et cetera? Are there specifics funding? And then I also want to have a follow-up question about that as well. So let's address that. Any specific funding sources that they should be looking at?
So one is, there's always fiscal sponsorship, right? So fiscal sponsorship is where an organization, a nonprofit organization, can actually become the pass-through entity for grant funding. So that's a possibility. So something to think through. I think the other thing on this kind of pro bono, low bono front is Catherine Darmstadt of Latent Design had an approach where when she wasn't able to get as much funding from her partners, she would ask them for key benefits that would benefit her firm, and she would actually write them into the contract. So for example, she really wanted to give a presentation on her work and her design work to their board members. And so that might be something that you think about, is what else does your entity need that maybe is non-financial, but that you are potentially spending money on doing or spending time on achieving, right? You know, getting face time in front of other key clients. And are there ways that you can translate those things into things that your partner can provide for you?
And I want to pick up on one of the last words you just used, translating. I think that's another really important thing to keep in mind, thinking about where the money comes from, especially for firms or foundations or state agencies, as you said, Vanessa, that might not have specific money allocated. I think translating your work into the language of the funder or the client can be a really useful tool. And we saw this a couple times actually in some of the case studies. So for example, Util, which is a firm based in Boston, spoke about how when they first started working with city government, they talked a lot about trying to create social impact in the city and trying to really improve certain aspects. And the department said they were talking to were kind of like, you know, social impact, like, sorry, that's not what we're trying to do right here. And the more they talked about it and the more they got to know these organizations and department heads, they realized what they really care about is economic development. When we say social impact, we really are also talking about economic development. It's just that that's the language they use. They speak about all these types of impacts as forms of economic development. And so I think that's a good example of understanding how translating or code switching, just using different language to describe what you're doing, can really help the client or the funder understand how what you're doing actually helps them accomplish the goals they're already working towards. And I'll just share one other quick example, again, from one of the case studies from Mass Design Group. They spoke about how when they were fundraising for some of the hospitals they were building in countries around Africa, they said at first foundations and philanthropists weren't interested in just funding hospitals. They're like, there's lots of organizations that do that. We're not interested in hospitals. We're trying to make big picture impact on things. And so then they started talking about these projects, not as hospitals, but as opportunities to improve access to healthcare, to improve maternal health, to provide jobs and economic development for rural villages. And suddenly all these foundations were like, oh, wow, yeah, we want to support those things. And yeah. Oh, if building a hospital is the way you're going to do that, great, we'll give you money for it. So I think that idea of code switching and translating to really make sure you're speaking the language of the client or the funder could be a powerful approach.
Yeah, that's very interesting. When Vanessa's question came up, the first thing that popped into my mind was Inscape. And how they sort of build, they have Inscape Publica, which is one of your case studies. For anybody who's listening who doesn't realize that, it's Inscape Publica, which is their nonprofit, and then Inscape Studio, that then the nonprofit is feeding the for-profit company. So they do the work for as the nonprofit, and then they have services that they provide as for-profit. And when I saw that presentation on Maya's webinar, my thought was, well, that's reversed. That's backwards. What my thought, whenever those businesses come up on the business plan competition, I always think, well, why not build the profitable thriving business first, and then have the entire intent of that thriving business feeding the nonprofit side of what you do. So whether you start with the business first, that you build a thriving, profitable business, that then you take those profits and you feed them right into your nonprofit, or you partner with somebody, maybe you don't want to build a profitable business, so you partner with somebody who does love that side of it. You run the nonprofit side of it, and that becomes your funding source. That this profitable, thriving business now gives you the funds to go do the nonprofit things you want to do. And maybe it's even the nonprofit side is actually applying for grants from the profit side, and you provide grants to the nonprofit side. What are your thoughts on that, sort of reversing that model and building the profitable business first that then feeds the nonprofit side?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think that some people would say, I think a little bit more from the sort of, say, community organizing or advocacy space, like, don't jump into doing this sort of social impact work. Like, get good at your technical skills. Like, do what you're really good at doing and hone the skills. And after you've been doing that for a while, figure out how you can apply those. Figure out how those can be put in the service of communities or in the public at large. So I think there is a lot of value to this idea of really focusing on your business first, making sure it's profitable, making sure you know how to run an entire project, manage all the funds for a project, make sure you know how to accomplish stuff and complete a project on time, on budget, maybe even under budget, and make sure you have the staff to do that work and make sure you really understand the complexities of the type of work you're doing, and then figure out how you can start applying those skills to socially relevant projects.
I think that there's just different pathways there, and they have trade-offs, right? So I think sometimes, I think that there's this idea that you should do well and then do good. There's also, of course, a trade-off mentality that tells us you can either do well or do good, right? By do well, I mean make money, do good. And I just think that there's different ways to move forward, right? If you can find a niche, right? A thing that there are funding streams for, whether they're coming from the beneficiaries, the end users, or from funders, and you have the credibility to position your services in those ways, and you can, turn the profit that is right for your business to turn, that keeps it sustainable in the long term. I mean, I think that's great too, right? I think there's different pathways for different people. I will say that in the coaching work I do, which again is on the individual basis, I have people think about the long-term North Star, where they're ultimately trying to go, which is, it's hard for people sometimes to say, like, well, I don't know where I want to go because all I know is what's 5 feet in front of me. But I have people try to find a North Star. And then when you know where you might want to be in the future, it's easier to then back up and say, okay, what do I need to get there? And do I have to have it all at once? Maybe I don't, right? Maybe if I want to be a mission-driven real estate developer, well, there's a lot of skills I need to get and exposure and network I need to build in order to get there. So I might take a couple years working in a real estate firm because that's the fastest way to get that exposure, that language, that skill set, et cetera. And I know that it's actually part of a much longer game. So my advice is to kind of think through where you ultimately want to go. And then there's always multiple pathways to get there and to, do I want to do it this way? Do I want to do that? Is it worth giving this up for the short term in order to get that? And to think about it in that route. And to also know, by the way, that North Star is probably going to change, because when you take actions towards a more ambitious, and ambitious can even mean socially ambitious future, then, and this is going to sound very woo-woo, but sometimes the world comes out to meet you and presents you with opportunities or possibilities that you wouldn't have seen in the first place because you've raised your hand and you've said, yes, I'm interested in this. And then all of a sudden things start to look different to you. You start to see more opportunities and people know what you're interested in, what you're doing, and they start to send things your way.
And just for the record, that's not woo-woo. That's the world. That's the way the world works. You get what you give. If you keep giving and giving and giving, people will give right back to you.
Yeah, you gotta show up.
Yep, exactly. We will be right back to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, Gusto, Arcat, and FreshBooks. If you own a business or know someone who does, you probably know that us small firm business owners, we wear a lot of hats. And some of those hats are totally great, but some, like filing taxes and running payroll, not so great. That's where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and simple management tools all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes so you don't have to worry about it. Plus, they make it easy to add on health benefits and even 401ks for your team. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. So let Gusto wear one of your many hats. You have better things to do. Listeners to the Entree Architect podcast get 3 months free when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see for yourself at entrearchitect.com/gusto. That's entrearchitect.com/GUSTO. It's what every professional in architecture dreads. Editing down a manufacturer's specifications. Did that just make your skin crawl? Did that just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up? You're staring down a 54-page specification and you just need one product. Just one product and all of its attributes. That's all you need. There is a better way. And it's not throwing the entire specification into the project documents. That's a waste of time. That's a waste of money. It's RCAT.com's Spec Wizard. Spec Wizard is a unique tool that allows you to specify a product in minutes, not hours, by turning a specification into a simple-to-use website. Just select the products and options you want to specify and generate a 3-part CSI specification in multiple formats. And best of all, it's free. And it requires no registration. You don't even need to send them your email address. It's all free, just like everything at RCAT. So go to entrearchitect.com/RCAT, entrearchitect.com/ARCAT, and try the better way of specifying products. RCAT's Spec Wizard. Do you remember when you started your small firm? It was no small feat. It took lots of late nights, early mornings, and maybe even the occasional all-nighter. Bottom line, you've been busy, insanely busy, ever since. So why not make things a little bit easier? Well, our friends at FreshBooks have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners. It's simple, intuitive, and it keeps you way more organized than the dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and then get them paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. File expenses even quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. And the best part, FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools that you need when you need them without ever having to learn the ins and outs of accounting. Join the 24 million people who've used FreshBooks. Try it for free for 30 days. That's free for 30 days. No catch, no credit card. Free. 30 days. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. And enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. Gusto, RCAT, and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today. And thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. And I invite, Vanessa has posted some of her progress in the chat box. Vanessa, if you want to come on and share it with the rest of us, I would love for you to do that. Put your camera on and your mic and just talk about what you're doing and have Maya and Gilad sort of, give you some feedback on what you're doing or just promote what you're doing so we can learn. You have your audio on? Oh, hold on. You're muted.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm very active with AI New York, and I know a lot about licensure in New York State. And I recently started my own business, and it's been a little bit of a nightmare navigating the New York State Regulatory Board. And I know Robert Lopez very well. My initial idea was to have an architecture firm and potentially have a nonprofit arm or related under a specific brand. can't do that. And I had a conversation with Rob. It's interesting, in New York State, it's pretty specific, the legislation related to what you're allowed to do for an architecture firm, and it's provide architectural services. Mm-hmm. The definition of that is questionable. There's New York is its own landscape, so I'm trying to figure out how to do it, at least through my business entity that took me about a year to create for now, and then see if I need another. I really appreciate the concept of translating with the different agencies, and because I think that there's definitely funding available. It's easier to get through nonprofits than it is to get through a for-profit architecture firm. And so I'm also in the process of doing like a minority-owned business and women-owned business. So it'll get me in the pipeline, but a lot of the projects that I really want to do, there's no funds available to do them.
You guys have any thoughts or advice?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is just what you said about the fact that they're more likely to hire or provide contracts for nonprofits. I think partnerships can be really powerful. So finding the nonprofits that are doing work that's related to the types of services you want to provide, or working on issue areas or with people who you would really like to be providing services for, or using your work to address those issues, and building relationships with those nonprofits and then going after stuff together. To something we spoke about earlier about the idea of expanding the scope of services when you're doing this type of work. I've heard a number of firms talk about the fact that they work directly with nonprofits, and they'll actually do a lot of the grant writing themselves because the nonprofit's too busy, they can't invest in this, but the designer's like, hey, I have this idea about how I could help advance this issue that you're already working on. And they're like, great, we'll sign off on it, you do the grant writing, and if we get the project, you'll be the person we hire to work on that. So I think thinking about how to partner with others who are already in that system or already have those qualifications or legal structures that are most kind of like apt to work in that.
Yeah. So I have to talk to my lawyer, but when I talked to Robert Lope, to the state board, they said that if I do grant writing, I shouldn't do it under my architecture firm. I should do it under myself as a consultant, and it has to do with liability insurance and things that I'm qualified to do versus not qualified to do as a registered architect. So I'm trying to figure that out. But I just want to throw that out there for other people who are thinking about it. Just be careful what you're doing under which umbrella.
Yeah, that's good point. Tina made a suggestion as well, and I think it ties right into this, is Tina thinks that it would be helpful for you to be able to connect the people who are interested in what you're doing with one another. So is there a place that they can do that? Is there a Facebook group or a Slack group or something where people who are following proactive practices can connect and help one another?
Yeah. Well, so this came up in our last webinar. There's no Facebook group. There's no, you know, forum. So there's one very immediate opportunity which we can offer, which is if you are interested in having your info shared with other people who are interested in this, you can email hello@proactivepractices.org, and we'll collect some emails, and then we'll try to send out a big email just so that you have each other's contact info. You know, let's do it old school style. The other venue that we love, and you know, we've talked about it over and over, is the Association for Community Design has an annual conference. It has membership network organization Gilad. Either was on the board or is currently on the board of it. And it's the place to go. There aren't that many institutions in the public interest design world. And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate because there's a lot of people who are interested in doing this work, but I would say that's a great place to get connected to other architects and built environment designers. There's also the Open Architecture Network, which has all kinds of things that they do. And then finally, I haven't been involved with it for a number of years, but I do know that as of a couple of years ago, IDEO.org was running a online forum where they would actually put out challenge projects and you could connect up with teams. And it was kind of a, you know, another watering hole online for getting connected and doing this kind of work. So those are some places that you can go, and we are happy to be the matchmakers. What I'll say is that you know, maybe you connect with a bunch of people here, or maybe you just find one person who is an accountability partner, someone who's also trying to push forward this kind of work. I have a business wingwoman. She runs a company out in Portland. We met online about 4 years ago. She was my first, you know, online friend, which 4 years ago seemed very sketchy. But we have been having pretty much weekly accountability calls. She runs a totally different business than I do. For about 4 years, we now do an annual business retreat. You know, I've written marketing copy for her. She's made spreadsheets for me. I mean, we're like all up in each other's business, and I really, like, I call her my business wife. and having that relationship has been so instrumental to me making decisions, pushing things forward. You know, the first sales call that scared me, you know, she said, practice on me. And I called her up. She's like, don't tell me when you're calling. I called her up in the middle of the week and I said, hi, Kristen, I wanted to know. And I practiced my sales skills on her. And so, you know, connecting with a bunch of people is great. And also sometimes you just need that one person who helps cheer you on and who sees that same vision that you see.
Yeah. And I just want to add to what Maya was saying. You know, at the beginning, I am still part of the organization ACD, which is the Association for Community Design. And I just posted a link in the chat box about our conference that's coming up June 28th and 29th in Greenwood, Mississippi. And if you can only make it for one day, a lot of the stuff happens on the 29th, which is a Saturday. So most folks should be able to make it. And that's an organization that's been around since the 70s as a network of community design centers, which are, you know, small, often nonprofit, sometimes independent, sometimes tied to universities, essentially nonprofit design firms that are doing a host of different work and providing a host of different services to really add value to the communities that they live and work in. And so it's just a conference of all the people across the country who are doing that work, coming together to share their strategies, their stories, their tactics, and everything they've learned. So if you're really interested in this really community-based or community-engaged approach to design work, I'd really highly recommend in coming to the ACD conference. It's a place where I think you'll really find, like, you'll find your people.
Yeah, and I would second accountability partners, Maya. I think that they're super powerful. Mastermind groups, you know, find a mastermind group that's all focused on the same thing and meet on a regular basis and hold one another accountable. And I encourage Tina, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I encourage Tina to create that Slack group right now and post the link right here, and we'll promote it on this video, and it'll be here for eternity. And it's not that hard to do. If you're on Slack, start a group, post a link in that chat box right there, and we'll let people know about it.
I would also just
instant
add
action.
In terms of Slack, I'm actually already a part of a couple different Slack groups out there. All have their own specific flavor, but focused on this type of work. So I would also encourage you to just Google online or search through Slack to find channels where people are talking about this kind of stuff, because there are definitely communities out there of people trying to do this already.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's Facebook groups and Slack groups and all kinds of things. But if there are fans of proactive practices and they want to create a Slack group for proactive Slack, you let them do it. Could be powerful.
You be proactive by creating your Slack group today.
Because there are a bunch of people saying they're in. You can create a Slack group. You have three people who said they're in. So I have a question for you. So you started this 5 years ago. You've said multiple times in both webinars that this took much longer than you ever imagined it would take. What are some of the surprises or lessons that you learned that when you started this, you thought you were going to head in this direction and you ended up in a completely different place? Are there any specific things that you sort of learned along the way of these 5 years?
Yeah, well, so I'll share a quick story that has been in the back of my mind ever since we decided to do this capstone webinar series. So when we started this project, we reached out to a couple of mentors. Many of them became part of our advisory group, who were a group of loose, informal advisors who were giving us advice on the project. And one of our mentors, John Carey, he said something about the concept of learned helplessness, which is learned helplessness is It's a mindset that people develop. Sometimes if you're in an environment where you don't have a lot of empowerment or agency, you can develop it. But it's a mindset that you develop where you feel like you can't actually change anything, right? Learned helplessness is the reason why people don't organize to change political conditions. Learned helplessness is the mindset piece of why change doesn't or one of the mindset pieces of why change doesn't happen. And we were like, yeah, okay, thanks. But anyways, tell us about business models, right? And, and 5 years later, and, you know, my pathway has taken me to, you know, at first running a design consultancy and then deciding to go fully all in on my empowerment coaching work. I just feel like I've seen it in action over and over and over again. And so, you know, the younger, more naive me that was like, sure, yeah, whatever, cool, mindset, whatevs, he was right. And I think that there's a moment, and actually you probably have that moment, you've probably had that moment multiple times in your career, where there's an opportunity to take a risk and you stay on this side of the line. I know I've been in that space a couple of times, and the times that I have stepped over the line, it's made all the difference. But it means acting when you don't know how it's all going to work out. It usually means exposing your ideas, your goals, your interests to rejection, vulnerability, right? Being visible in some way, shape, or form, putting something on the line. And I think that that mindset piece is so much more fundamentally important. And, you know, learning the way that you unlearn learned helplessness, if you struggle with it, is by taking actions that scare you. So if I had one takeaway, right, thinking back to then and you know, reflecting on now, it's really that, which is why I commend people like Vanessa, who has been thinking about this work for a long time and finally stepped out to start her own practice, right? Or people who take a risk, that first risk, whatever it is for you, is so, so important. And cultivating that aspect of yourself is so, so important.
Glad. Any surprises or lessons?
Yeah. I think that early on, I really thought that there were a concrete set of strategies that would enable anyone to do this. And I think early on, Maya and our other research partner, Nick, and myself talked about this idea of even creating like a deck of cards of like, we can literally codify every strategy that's used and you can just pick and mix and match and create any, you know, amazing business model you want. And I think what we found there are in fact a lot of core strategies, some specific to a project or a place or a firm, and some specific to a certain amount of funding that's available or anything else. There's tons of strategies, both common across firms and specific to individual projects. I think that what I learned was that it's actually the people that are much more important than the strategies that you're using or the business model you create. Because when I tried to take a step back and see like, okay, what is common across all of the firms we've looked at? How have they done this? What are the clear strategies that everyone's using? There weren't any. They were all different. And when I tried to think about it a little bit more, I realized the one commonality was that every single firm organization had a few people, whether that's one, two, three, or in some cases a small group of people who were leading this, who were saying, I'm dedicated to doing this. This is my passion. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to pursue. And they were problem solvers. When anything came up, they figured out a way to get around it or how to go through it or how to build on it and leverage it. So I think that to me, the big kind of insight I came away with from all of this research after, you know, 5 years was it's about people. It's about finding the people you want to work with and making commitments amongst yourselves to be dedicated to doing whatever you're going to do, regardless of what.
Can I add one more, Mark?
Yeah, go ahead.
So the other thing that I learned the hard way, and I think this actually is not unique to public interest business, I think it's just business, is that a business is a complex ecosystem and it will evolve slowly in pieces over time. So I think sometimes there's this desire to build the whole thing at once, and then you can get really frustrated when you're not where you want it to be. So for me, for example, I had this moment, I call it assistant capocalypse 2018, when my assistant ghosted me. I was in the middle of a bunch of high profile partnerships, everything kind of felt like it fell apart. And it was really clear that I needed more business systems. And I mean, that kind of stuff is really boring to me. So I really didn't, it made me realize that, you can't move everything forward at the same time, right? You can't have this perfect shiny thing that works in all the ways that you want it to work immediately. And, I'm impatient for change. I like things to happen tomorrow. And part of what I've had to learn is that it's okay to go after the long game and to recognize that you will go through seasons where you learn one skill or you build one capacity or your business moves from stage A to stage B in this realm. And it's okay for not everything to always move forward at the same time. And the long game is much more important than whether everything's perfectly optimized in every moment.
How important is it to plan it all out? Should we have a plan of where we want to go and what that looks like, and then sort of work our way backwards to what's the next step today to get to where we want to go? Is there a necessity for that long-term plan?
Gilad, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's a tough question to answer. I think that it's really always important to be kind of looking to the future and knowing where you're headed. But I guess the more recent kind of thing I've been thinking about a lot in response to this type of question is that, like, to really be present and to focus on what's right in front of you and do it really well. And just kind of, I know this sounds like a hippie, crunchy granola answer, but just kind of like have faith that when you take that next step, the ground will appear out from under you. And that as long as you're doing your work really well and you're following your passions and pursuing the type of projects you really want to be working on, that will help create more opportunities for you.
Yeah, I think sometimes on the learned helplessness front, one of the hiding strategies, Tara Moore, who's a women's coach who I really love, calls them hiding strategies, like ways we protect ourselves from being exposed, is planning and over planning. So I think sometimes what we see is people try to get all the information and figure out exactly how to do this the right way as a delay tactic. So the way I tend to operate is I like to have a really high level North Star that I'm working towards, an intention. And sometimes that intention is vague and sometimes it's really specific. It's like an image that I can see in my head. And then I try to have seasons of growth where I focus on a specific thing and really think about how am I growing the business, but how am I also growing my own skills and my capacity, and in the future, hopefully the skills and capacity of the people who work with me. And it's okay to just have one thing in front of you or a few things in front of you at a time. It's okay to have these seasons.
Yeah. One of the things that we teach at Entre Architect is to develop your mission and your vision. And we do that through a vision narrative, sort of write what you imagine your life would look like 5 years from now. If everything was perfect, there are no barriers or no obstacles, what would that world look like? And then work your way back to creating a mission and a vision statement. And the reason I think that's really important is it sort of becomes your North Star, Maya, that it's the thing that when that shiny object is presented to you, you can go back to your mission and your vision and say, does that fit within my mission and vision? And if it doesn't, then you have a choice. You can either say, okay, it doesn't, and reject it and say no, even if it's a great opportunity, and you can continue on in the direction that you want to go and get to that final destination. Or you can specifically and intentionally choose to take a new path with the knowledge that you're taking a new path. Without those two things of vision and mission, I think very often we end up walking around in circles. You sort of keep following that next step, but that next step just brings you back to where you started. You never get to where you want to go. And so I think it's really important to have some sort of definition of where you want to go and how you're ultimately going to get there, even if it's not fully developed, fully formed. Just in the chat box, Tina did create that Slack group. So everybody who's listening, and it's a big long link, so I can't promote it on the audio, but it's there. And so anybody who wants to be part of that Slack group, click that link, join that Slack group. And I encourage you to not just join that and have a bunch of conversations. Don't just talk about this. Make that Slack group something that you come together and you create a goal and you go do something. Don't just talk about doing something. Because I think a lot of times we have this idea that we want to do something and then we'll talk about it for the next 5 years. Create make that your accountability group. Make that your mastermind group and hold each other accountable for the things that you want to do and want to accomplish. Maya and Gilad, are there any other case studies? You've created an entire portfolio of case studies. And if anybody wants to go see those, if they haven't read the case studies and reviewed them, proactivepractices.org, they're all there for you to look at and read and learn everything that you want to learn about them. Are there any case studies that you've learned since then or knew that they were there, you just hadn't gotten to them? Are there specific case studies that you'd like to explore going forward?
Yeah, too many to list off right now. Maya and I, for a long time, had a spreadsheet going of all the firms we'd like to do case studies on in the future. And I think we kind of gave up on that when we got to about 150. So let's just say there's many out there that I would really love to do case studies on and learn more about and just, find out ways to share some of the things that they've developed. Just a couple that come to the top of my mind. The Center for Urban Pedagogy is an amazing organization based in New York City that does a wide variety of work. And I would just love to learn more about how they do what they do. There's a really cool design nonprofit in Cincinnati called Design Impact. That's really, really interesting. They do lots of work out there, really focused on socioeconomic development. There's a great firm out in California called Kunkui Design Initiative that does a lot with public spaces. So those are just kind of three that come to the top of my mind. But we would love to continue producing case studies. We're just in the slow process of trying to find the way to fund that. Because Proactive Practices was really a labor of love. And so we are trying to figure out how we can continue that work. But I just want to say that if you're interested and if you want to even get involved and help produce future case studies, please let us know. We're always looking for interested, passionate, talented people who want to be a part of this. So I'll put the email again in the chat box, but it's just hello@proactivepractices.org. That goes to us. And we'll definitely reach out to you if you email us and find ways that we could even work together in the future.
Yeah, so that's hello@proactivepractices.org. So if you're interested in being part of this mission and want to start helping with some of these case studies, you can email Gilad at hello@proactivepractices.org. What's next for Proactive Practices? So you've gone through this whole process of creating these case studies. You've developed your research. You're presenting it. You presented these great series of webinars. And again, I encourage you to go back to those first two, super important and powerful. What's next for Proactive Practices? Is this the end, or is this the beginning of the next step?
So for me, this is the end. It was so important for me to get this work out there in the world. It started for me as an independent study at design school. I really, really wanted to publish it and get it out. And that felt like the important thing to do in order to honor the time of the people who we interviewed. I do want to say it was a very much a labor of love, but we also got financial support from the National Endowment for the Arts, which was incredible. Also brought credibility and legitimacy to this project. And Penn Design ended up being the Penn Praxis was the institution that we went through. So I do want to say, and we got support, guidance, advice, a lot from them. So I want to say thanks to those. For me, when I looked forward at what it meant to keep following this work, I realized one of the things that I think was a learning from the case studies, which is at the end of the day, time and resources of time and attention and focus are really limited. And so I've actually gone from, 5 years ago, I was running a speaker series for local creatives and entrepreneurs. I was running a, I was trying to help found a co-working space, which, you know, Gaylat, you can talk to Gaylat if you want to know how it actually worked out for someone who actually pulled it off. I was running my design consultancy. I was running Build Yourself Workshop. I was running actually a kosher pop-up dinner club with an ex-partner. Like, it was like everything and anything. And over the last 5 years, I've actually slowly, you know, cut down to just focus on Build Yourself, because I really, you know, I've got this North Star vision of the kind of impact that I want to make. And, you know, I wanted to do one thing and really make a much, much bigger impact. So for me, Proactive Practices, my involvement with Proactive Practices, that's why I wanted to have this capstone to kind of close it off. But what I will say will continue is that, you know, there's an approach to looking deeply under the hood of a practice, which is, it's pretty accessible. You know, I have a habit where I invite out another business owner who I admire for an online coffee date every month. And one of the, and I guess this is a piece of advice, but really, I really try to show transparently what's under the hood of my business model, talk about, you know, what are the different programs or things that I offer, what's the revenue, what's the profit, really just sharing what's going on and then asking them questions about those same things. And it doesn't work with everybody, right? Not everybody's interested in sharing transparently, but it's been this way for me that I can get insight ideas. I mean, you know, Mark is one of my business wingmen, right? Like, we talk every couple of months about yeah. our business models. So I think I took that approach with me, and I'm also so happy that the result of that approach, it through the case studies, is out there for other people to take that with them.
If people wanted to get involved in what you're doing next, how do they do that?
Yeah. So I through Build Yourself, I run coaching and training programs for women in design. I work with a lot of mission-driven women. So if you're interested in connecting with me, you can email me at MIA@buildyourselfworkshop.com. If you're interested in working with me or coaching with me, you can do that. And if you want to get on my email list, you can text Build Yourself to 444-999. And I talk about issues of mission alignment. I talk about taking risks. I talk about, you know, facing fear of visibility. So I would love to connect with you through Build Yourself.
Before I ask Gaylat about the future of Proactive Practices, can you just post that link to your newsletter in the chat box?
Yeah.
Gaylat, so what about you? What's the next step for Proactive Practices, if there is one?
Yeah. So I just really like nerd out on this kind of stuff. I love finding out about business models and organizational structures and the ways that people, you know, structure, you know, practices that are working in the public interest. So let's just say I would love to keep producing case studies. What I think both Maya and I learned is that it takes a lot longer than we ever anticipated to go from finding a firm and interviewing them to producing a finished, you know, polished case study. So like I said, I'm actively seeking, you know, financial support. So if there's any funders here right now who are interested, you know, please reach out to me. But yeah, that's looking into different grant opportunities. I've been exploring ways to weave this into teaching. I'm trying to actually lead a course at Tulane University in the fall, keeping my fingers crossed. Hopefully that works. And thinking about ways that working with students and leading classes could be productive in sort of producing case studies. So yeah, if anyone here is interested, like I said, please email me. I'd love to talk more. But also trying to find ways that this can tie into my role leading research with the Association for Community Design. We're actively trying to produce more bodies of work that help inform people in the field. And so case studies on projects like this is definitely something we're looking into. I think ACD right now, in terms of research, is a little bit more focused on a specific area of this, which is actually what a lot of Proactive Practices has led me to, which is looking at more systemic injustices and specifically racial injustice, and how design firms and design organizations are trying to work around those issues and address those. So right now I'm working on a project where we're looking at business models, organizational structures, design processes, all the kind of the full range of stuff for a host of different firms around the country. We're not just doing public interest work, but really doing community engaged design practice projects that are focused on addressing issues of systemic injustice and specifically issues of racism. So I think that some of this research has just led me down further, you know, research holes, finding out more about specifics that I'm really interested in. And again, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, please come to the ACD conference because there will be lots of content there.
Yep. And you posted a link to that in the chat box. So if anybody wants to register for that. And I guess the best way to connect with you, Gilad, for anything is that hello@proactivepractices.org. Would that be a good way to remember
for people to reach out? Maybe the hello at Proactive, you know, if you're really interested in Proactive and you want to talk about the case studies or get involved, great. If you want to talk about anything else, you can just use my normal email. I'll post it here too. It's just my name, GiladMarone@gmail.com.
All right.
I just also thought it'd be helpful for folks to hear a little bit about you, where you are, and how they can get connected with you and how you can help them.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. EntreArchitect.com is our platform. It's a platform for small firms to build better businesses. And so we have a community and resources and membership. And if you want to create that model that I talked about earlier, where you build the thriving, profitable business first, and then you take that money and you fund your nonprofit, we can help you build that first phase. So EntreArchitect.com will give you everything that you need to know about me and what we're doing over there. And so, we're, you know, I'm super passionate. I think the world can change through architecture, through individual architects building stronger, thriving businesses. So it's not about the money. It's about what the money can bring us. And so that's why we're building Entre Architect. Thank you for that. So is there anything that either of you want to sort of wrap up before we close things out here?
Just thank you to everyone who's been to these webinars and who's read our case studies. And thank you to you, Mark, for moderating this panel. And, you know, just want to once again encourage anyone who's interested to reach out to us. We'd love to hear more from you.
Yeah, this has been an incredible journey. Doing this research, I think, was my first step off of the traditional pathway. And I just am really thankful for what I've learned, who I've connected with. And every time we get an email, someone is willing to write back and say, hey, this was interesting to me, or how can I do more? It's been really nice to hear other people's stories and how some of what we've put out there has influenced your pathway. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch both of you grow into your passions. I'm excited to see where Proactive Practices continues. I think this is just the beginning, first chapter of where it goes. I think maybe that Slack group might become the army that you need to build that next step, and build yourself is super important. And so I've seen where you started and where you are, and so I'm excited to watch where you're going. So thank you both for doing what you do. And thank you, everybody who attended today. I think this is a super interesting and important webinar. And thanks for contributing and being part of it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks again. Have a good day.
So that was episode 278 of the Entre Architect podcast. You could learn more about Maya Sharfi and her workshop at buildyourselfworkshop.com. And you could follow along as Gilad takes Proactive Practices to the next level, to the next generation, to the evolution of Proactive Practices and what that becomes. If you want to get involved, go check out Proactive Practices at proactivepractices.org. And if you want to join the Entre Architect membership, go check it out at entrearchitect.com/join. It is monthly training, live monthly training at a webinar with Q&A every month. So we bring in an expert every month to teach us something about business, life, or leadership as a small firm architect. It's a great resource. You know, you can subscribe, and then every month you have a new live training. You learn something every month. Step it up. One month at a time, build a better business so you can be a better architect. Then you have access to the entire archive of training, plus tons of resources and checklists and forms, and access to our full member forum on Slack.
So check that out at entrearchitect.com/join. Every small firm architect should be a member of Entree Architect. If you are an entrepreneur architect and you run or own your own small firm, then you are an Entree Architect. And I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, share. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.